And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's all football today, and part one of today's program will feature a newly recorded interview with the author of a biography of one of the most admired college football coaches in recent history. In part two, out of the archives, an interview from earlier this year with the author of a very interesting book called The Rise of the Black Quarterback. Here's part one. One of the names that looms large in the history of college football is Era Parseghian, a renowned college football coach best remembered for his great success at the University of Notre Dame, leading the Fighting Irish to undisputed national championships both in 1966 and 1973. He retired while just in his early 50s and became a very successful businessman as well as television commentator, and also devoted time and energy to an array of humanitarian causes, some of them prompted by family tragedy. This great human being is brought to life in a marvelous new biography called Era, The Life and Legacy of a Notre Dame Legend. The author is Mark O. Hubbard, the author before this of the book Undisputed Notre Dame, National Champions 1966, and also co-author of the book Forgotten Four, Notre Dame's Greatest Backfield and the 1953 Undefeated Season. This new book, Era, The Life and Legacy of a Notre Dame Legend, was published by the University of Notre Dame Press. Mark Hubbard, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I really have enjoyed this book so much. And I'm old enough to remember Coach Era Parseghian when he was coach at Notre Dame. I remember that name well and his remarkable legacy. Explain to our listeners your connection with him and the way in which this opportunity came your way to write this biography about him.
Well, it's a very interesting story because when I was a student here, I had no association with the coach, very little with the football team, obviously. And it was later in my life that my brother and I wrote a book about the 1953 team called Forgotten Four, got some attention, and a local sports writer here that I knew, Joe Doyle, at the South Bend Tribune, thought that I should be the guy that could write a definitive book about the 1966 national championship season. So he arranged for me to meet Era. The three of us got together, and that was the beginning of it all. And from there, that book was well-received, well-researched, well-thought of. And after Era passed, Mrs. Parseghian, Katie, called me 2 years later and said that she would like me to begin the biography because she knew that I knew Era, and she thought that I had done a very good job on Undisputed, the book about the 66 team. And so that was 5 years ago, and now we have the books on the shelf. That's the result of 5 years of hard work, and it's a very unlikely place for a architecture student in, you know, 1967 to end up writing a biography of a very legendary coach at Notre Dame.
He certainly did a lot to make this task more doable for you, in that he left behind him such an incredible legacy, including written legacy, and I know that a lot of that proved to be tremendously valuable for you.
Yeah, when we started the project, you get afraid of the idea that you're going to write about a very famous person, and you're going to have to chronicle a life really from the beginning till the end, and you wonder, how are you going to fill some of the voids? It's like putting together a picture puzzle, and can you get enough pieces to make it make sense? Well, the beauty is that once Katie and I started working on the project, she made available all of Era's files and records and things, of which there were many. I mean, I think he saved every letter that it was ever sent to him, and he copied all the correspondence. He was a very literate guy and used mail a lot. And, of course, he was interviewed a number of times, and we got to primary sources. So all of those voids that I was worried about as we began the process were largely filled with, you know, documented evidence left behind by the coach or people that knew him that I could rely on with a high degree of trust. And so it made the task, I'm not going to say it was easy, but it made it easier to piece together the entirety of a life, authentic materials. When I needed them, there always seemed to be something that I could reach for to kind of address the subject. So I was very lucky in that regard, and I think the readers will find this to be a very worthwhile chronicle of a life without a lot of extra fanfare. It's pretty straightforward, but he was a wonderful person, and he lived till 94, so he coached only till he was 51. He had a lot of years to fill after he started, he ended coaching. So we had to address those as well, including some family tragedies with his daughter and his grandchildren that really colored the remainder of his life after his 70s. Yeah. So I was very fortunate to have good base materials to work with.
You tell us that he was a relatively late comer to the game of football. He played basketball and baseball in high school, but at first not football because his mother was worried about the injuries. Tell our listeners how he was able to actually become part of the high school football team.
Well, it was kind of through subterfuge. His older brother, Jerry, when he started college, he was 2 years older, he faked the permission slip from Eric's parents so he could go out for the team. And Era's mother didn't even know he was on the team until she saw his picture in the newspaper. I don't know exactly how that went down at home, but he continued on the team, so they must have come to some family resolution. And, of course, aren't we glad that he started his football career in high school and then played football all the way through the pros and became a great coach. But football was not on his radar screen until his junior year in high school.
Right. Well, he ultimately proved to be a good enough football player to play for a time in the NFL. But obviously his ultimate legacy, his destiny, was to become a coach. And one of the things that was important to understand about why he was such a good coach was partly his extensive experience as a player, and you take time to kind of underline that, and also some of the really great, even legendary coaches whom he came to know and work with early in his life. Tell us about both of those factors that contributed to him being such a successful coach.
Well, one of the things that is important to understand Era is that he played football, high school and college, and in the pros, in single platoon football. So if you were on the field, you had to play offense and defense. And so he developed an appreciation of the game from both sides of the ball and kind of a view of how to strategically win in that context. And so he was able to bring that to his coaching. And, of course, the rule in college changed in 1966, and he was able to take advantage of then putting the players that he inherited at Notre Dame in the right positions, both on offense and defense, which was one of the things that distinguished him in his first year. But along the way, he was fortunate to run into some good coaching tutors as well. You know, when he was in the Navy, he played 1 year with Paul Brown at the Great Lakes Naval Training Station, the Blue Jackets. They had essentially a college football team, and Paul Brown was the coach. And even though Era was injured that year, he was able to travel with the team and watch the coaching style of Paul Brown. And he'd readily admit that Paul Brown was one of the big influences in his life. When he got to college, he had a good college coach, but he was plucked out of Miami after his junior year. He was offered a number of contracts with the Steelers, the Browns, and the Pittsburgh Pirates. He was He was a great athlete, and he decided to go with Paul Brown and the Cleveland Browns in the American Football Conference. And Paul Brown wanted him badly because he remembered him from his days at Great Lakes. And so he then played 2 years of pro ball. 1 year was injured, but he played his first year. He was Rookie of the Year on the Browns. And again, added more coaching credentials from Paul Brown as a pro coach that he was able to absorb. Now, the big surprise for most people is that once he was injured and he was essentially without a job, he was offered the freshman coaching job at Miami University in Ohio. That was his alma mater. They were looking for a freshman coach. And the new head coach that year was Woody Hayes, who went on to have a great career, obviously, at Ohio State. And Hayes hired him as a freshman coach. And I think Era would tell you that he learned a lot from Woody Hayes as well. Some of it good, some of it not so good. But Woody was a different kind of coach than Paul Brown. And after Woody left Miami, the job opening came for head coach at Miami University, and they gave the job to a 27-year-old guy named Era Parseghian, and the rest kind of blossomed from there.
Right.
So he had good mentors along the way, but Miami was a very good place for him to learn coaching on his own. He had never been a head coach of any place, you know, high school, anything. And all of a sudden he was running a program that was playing one Big Ten team a year and had a pretty strong schedule in mid-sized colleges. And so he was able to hone his coaching skills little by little in an environment that was very, very receptive to his to him and his growth, so to speak.
And, of course, he goes on from there to coach at Northwestern University. And you say a good case could be made that Era Parseghian saved the Northwestern University football program from very likely extinction. And that's in and of itself an interesting story. But what I want to just move past to say is that you quote a writer, John Underwood, something that he wrote for the first College Football Hall of Fame, when he says, more than any other, football is a coach's game. And so what he's underscoring, and you obviously agree, is that college football is an arena in which coaching is of paramount importance, more so than in the professional ranks.
I believe that. Of course, John Underwood became a friend of mine, and he is a great author and contributed to Sports Illustrated and wrote a great book about Ted Williams and Bear Bryant. But it was an insightful comment, and I think if you look at great teams, especially in college over the years, you will find that great coaches have great teams, and there are very few great teams you can't point to a great coach with a long-term record of coaching. And so it's a comment that I think makes sense. I'm not sure it makes as much sense today, given the change in the alignment of conferences and the portal and NIL, and it seems like even head coaches are changed out with relative ease for whatever reasons. But in what I call the golden era of college football, which probably is the 60s through the early 2000s, college coaching was paramount. And you can look at the great coaches, and you can name the teams, and you probably can name the coach right after naming the teams. It's pretty easy to do.
Well, of course, what he is best known for, best remembered, is his distinguished success at Notre Dame. And the story of him getting that position is as interesting as his time as the coach. I mean, the circumstances under which this highly prized position was offered to him. And one of the things you spend a fair amount of time talking about in your book is the whole matter of religion. And, of course, Notre Dame being a Catholic university, in which religion was deeply ingrained into the whole culture of the place. And Era Parsegian was what we would say kind of a drifting away Catholic. And this was a matter that was very sensitive, and it was of concern to him. Explain kind of how this complicated matters, but was ultimately resolved.
Well, when the administration at Notre Dame was looking for a head football coach in the 1963 season, they I'm sure got feelers from a lot of people, but Era was one, and he had the benefit of beating Notre Dame in the three seasons prior to 63. So he was a known entity at a school with high academic standards in the Chicago market, which is a big market for the Notre Dame faithful. And when he interviewed for the job, he was concerned that he may not get it because he was basically a fallen away Catholic. Now, his Catholic heritage has really only recently come to light, and this book kind of is probably one of the things that is revealing that. So Father Hesburgh and Father Joyce, who were the administrators, knew of that, and Era was concerned that he might be viewed as being a fallen away Catholic and not worthy of the job. And so there was a hiccup around his being announced as the head coach. There was a pause in that, and then they came back with a second press conference when he resolved that in his own mind, and then he was made head coach. And I think what a great benefit that is to Notre Dame. And I think the administration here appreciated his honesty, and his religion was never an issue here while he was a coach. I think today a lot of Notre Dame people would have comfort in the fact that he was actually raised in the tradition of the Catholic Church as a young person, so that's kind of one of the big reveals in the book. But he was a fine individual, high integrity, and so he fit naturally into the Notre Dame culture.
Absolutely. We have just a minute or two left, but I want to give you a chance to tell one of my favorite stories in the book, which is about when he first comes to Notre Dame and he needs to start filling coaching assignments. And he encounters, under really interesting circumstances, a young man named Brian Bulak, who
yes.
ultimately becomes Mr. Parsegian's first hire. It's a wonderful story. Do you mind telling it?
Not at all. Of course, after they named him coach late in 63, he had to come to campus to check out his office and so forth before the new year started, and there were no students on campus. Somebody must have given him the keys to the office over at the Rockne Memorial Building, and he went to the office, and in the back of the office there was a fellow working in the film machine watching film. And his first comment was, "Who the hell are you?" And the young man said, he introduced himself as Brian Bulak. He said that he was, one of the student coaches, so to speak, assistants. And he was just looking at film of high school football players because nobody else was going to do it. He thought he might just do it because he wasn't going to go home to Washington State for Christmas. And so he and Era talked about that, and Era offered him a job on the spot, so he became essentially the first hire that Era made on a really dreary day in late December was Brian Bulak. And Brian stayed with Era all the way through his coaching career and had a long career at Notre Dame after that. He coached softball, and he was an administrator in the athletic department. And he is a very interesting case because he probably is the person with the most national championship rings in football, given that he has four, two with Era and one with Lou Holtz and one with Dan Devine. So he is an interesting trivia question answer out there that he has four national championship rings in football. But it all started in a darkened room in December of 63, and I was fortunate to know Brian before his passing, and his wife, Mickey, was a great help in the book. She's still living, and their four daughters are very close, and she was one of the primary sources, as was Brian, to help me write the book. So I'm very grateful for their contribution.
It's a wonderful book, and it tells the story of his great success at Notre Dame. And I want to just add parenthetically, at the very end of the book, chapter 26, a chapter called Dear Coach, you share with us some excerpts from some of the remarkable letters, of the thousands of letters received by Coach Parsegian after his retirement and in those last decades of his life. He had a tremendous impact on the young men whom he coached, and that is part of his legacy told beautifully in your book, Era, The Life and Legacy of a Notre Dame Legend, the authorized biography of Coach Era Parsegian, published by University of Notre Dame Press, Mark O. Hubbard, the author. Mr. Hubbard, thank you so much for giving the world this wonderful book, and thanks for being my morning show guest today.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD, FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show Archives.
This is the first book I've ever written, and you know, from speaking to friends of mine who've written books, like the first one, and a chance to do more of them, they have to be things that you're passionate about, and they have to be things that you really want to spend a lot of hours on, you know, trying to make as full as you possibly can. And I've always been interested in history, and you know, back in 2019, I went to my editors at ESPN, and I told them that I wanted to examine black quarterbacks that season, because that was actually the 100th season of the NFL. The NFL was commemorating its 100th anniversary in that season, and it just seemed to me, from talking to people, that black quarterbacks who had been historically among the most marginalized players in the NFL had risen to a point at that point where it was no longer, you know, an oddity to see a black quarterback. You talk about your experience growing up, you know, as a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, and Jefferson Street, Joe Gilliam. It was such a strange thing, really, for lack of a better way to put it, to see a black man playing quarterback in the NFL in the 1970s. But by 2019, things had gotten to a point where black quarterbacks were on the verge of having the greatest seasons they had ever had. And the juxtaposition of the 100th season of the NFL, I just thought there was something there. Well, as it turned out, Lamar Jackson of the Baltimore Ravens won the NFL MVP award. He was only the second unanimous winner of that award as a quarterback. He joined Tom Brady in that category, the legendary quarterback who's now at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. You had Patrick Mahomes lead the Kansas City Chiefs to the Super Bowl, and he won the Super Bowl MVP award. You had Russell Wilson have another great season with Seattle. He probably, if the award had not been won unanimously by Lamar Jackson, Russell Wilson would have been second in that voting. You had Kyler Murray, who was the number one overall draft pick coming into that season, who won the AP Rookie of the Year award. And then Dak Prescott with the Dallas Cowboys had a great season. So as it turned out, black quarterbacks did have an unprecedented season. And after the season, it's funny, I was actually in my Uber going to the airport after the Chiefs had defeated the San Francisco 49ers in Miami at the Super Bowl, and I'm in my Uber going back, and I got a couple of calls from book agents who told me they'd be following my season-long series, and they thought there was a book here. Well, as it turned out, there was a book here.
That's for sure. I mean, it's an amazing book, and you explore so much here, and I so deeply appreciate the care with which you've told this important story. And, of course, you're absolutely right. We're getting to a point now where it almost seems ludicrous to even talk about a black quarterback in the NFL, as ludicrous as we would say, oh, he's a black wide receiver. I mean, it's to the point now where there are so many luminaries, and they are becoming a dominant presence, and also, in a sense, kind of a normal presence in the NFL in a way that would have been unthinkable a half a century ago. One of my questions is, why do we, generally speaking, know so little about the start of this, compared to, for instance, the way in which just about all of us know who Jackie Robinson was? How is it that the start of this particular story is so obscure for just about all of us?
Well, you know, that's a great point, that it is really obscure, that, that, you know, many of these people have been lost to history. And I think part of the reason why is that when we look at the emergence of the NFL as the dominant sports league in America and really the most powerful and successful sports league in the history of professional sports, it was a journey that was many decades in the making. And by the, you know, we know so much about Jackie Robinson because, remember, back in the 1940s, and the 50s, and even, you know, into the 60s, Major League Baseball was the dominant sport in America. So when you look at the NFL really it didn't have as many eyeballs on it. So, you know, we can go back to the start of the NFL back in 1920, and, you know, we have Fritz Pollard, who's the first black star player in the NFL, and he actually winds up being the first black coach, and he's also the first black quarterback. Now, quarterback looked much different back then, but he did line up at quarterback. And then we have to go really all the way to 1968 to see Marlon Briscoe, who's the first black quarterback of the modern era. So, really, there was so much time there, and including in this time is a 12-year ban where African Americans were not allowed to play in the NFL, that the country wasn't focused on that league in the way that it was hyper-focused on Major League Baseball. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that we don't know, or at least I hope we know now after people read this book, that many people aren't aware of the stories of the players who came before the Patrick Mahomeses and the Lamar Jacksons of the world.
And you are serving all of us so well by telling us these important stories. For any of you joining us, I'm speaking with Jason Reed, author of the brand new book, Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. You touched on the name of Marlon Briscoe, and his story is particularly interesting. And of course, also a story which we read with frustration, if not outright rage, in terms of the way in which he was treated by the Denver Broncos and their head coach at the time. First of all, describe the high quality of his rookie season with the Denver Broncos and the circumstances under which he even started as their quarterback.
Yeah, Marlon's story is really one of my favorite chapters in the book, but also probably the saddest chapter in the book. Marlon Briscoe was a star quarterback at the University of Nebraska-Omaha, not a big school, and he didn't fit the prototypical size of a quarterback. Marlon was 5'9", 5'10", maybe 175 pounds, dripping wet. And, you know, back in 1968, when Marlon was entering the NFL, well, at the time, the AFL draft, the old AFL before the AFL and the NFL merged, black men were not being drafted to play quarterback in either of the two major professional football leagues in the country at that point. If a black quarterback in college was good enough or considered good enough by the NFL and AFL to make it to the pros, that player understood he would just have to change positions. Black quarterbacks were changed to be wide receivers. They were changed to be cornerbacks predominantly. Other positions as well. You know, some would be running backs, some would be safeties. But the reality of it is you knew you had to change positions. Well, the Broncos drafted Marlon in the 14th round of the AFL draft. You know, he's a low-round draft pick, but they thought he had potential at cornerback. Well, Marlon throws him a curveball. He says, I won't sign as a cornerback unless you give me a tryout at quarterback. And the team thought he was being ridiculous, but they, you know, they played along. The process was completely rigged, of course. I mean, he never had a chance to actually, no matter how well he performed, actually be the team's quarterback. But he did, by all accounts from researching the book, perform well. And, you know, Marlon told me when we sat down for an interview, like, no, I did very well. But he knew that he wouldn't get the job. So anyway, what happened was the starter of the team at quarterback winds up getting hurt. Other players are ineffective. The team gets off to a bad start. So they throw Marlon in there because, you know, they don't think, okay, there's nobody better and, you know, they're not having a good season anyway. Well, you know, shockingly to the people around the team, Marlon played very well. And he set the Denver Broncos rookie record, which still stands today, for touchdown passes. He finishes high in the AFL Rookie of the Year voting. And he goes home to Omaha to work on his degree, and he gets a phone call from someone in Denver who tells him that, hey, just to let you know, they're having quarterback meetings out here. And Marlon's like, well, that's impossible. I'm the quarterback. They couldn't do that. Comes to find out that the team took the job away from him. No reason was given. Marlon told me that later he had heard that management was concerned about how white fans would react to him being the quarterback moving forward. You know, that it would be it was one thing when they were having a bad season and throw him in there as emergency. It was quite another to start a season with him there. So the team winds up releasing him. Marlon reinvents himself as a wide receiver, and he has a very good career moving forward as a wide receiver with the Buffalo Bills, goes to the Miami Dolphins, gets traded there, wins a couple of Super Bowls, was on the Miami Dolphins' undefeated team with Don Shula as the head coach. And you know, he goes on to after retirement from the NFL, Marlon was always good with numbers, and he winds up making a good living in the financial industry. But his story takes a turn because he gets hooked on drugs, and he winds up going to jail. And you know, Marlon told me that he will never blame his drug addiction specifically on what happened to him, that this job that he loved, that he proved he could do, was taken away from him. But that was that did create a hole in him. And it was taken from him for no other reason than racism. And when we talk about like pioneers, like we have to talk about Marlon Briscoe, who many people have never heard that name, but Marlon Briscoe really was the first one to get the door open, and sadly was taken away from him.
Hmm. And of course, your book is not only about stories that are laced with those kind of indignities, but ultimately your book tells stories of greater success achieved by the likes of course, Warren Moon and Michael Vick and Doug Williams and many, many others, to say nothing of the spectacular young black quarterbacks who are such an integral part of the NFL today. One of the things your book does, of course, is helps us understand what that attitude was all about. That is, that attitude that shut out blacks from the position of quarterback at a time when they were welcome to play other positions. And you make a very persuasive case for this really coming down to a gross misunderstanding of the leadership qualities of the typical black man. Tell us more about what the fears were of, for instance, coaches and owners in terms of if a black man was given the reins of a quarterback, of a team as their quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems crazy now what I'm about to say, but the prevailing belief among the people who held the marionette strings in the NFL for most of NFL history was that black men were just inherently inferior to white men and lacked the intelligence, the leadership capability, the toughness, the courage to succeed at the most important position in all of team sports. And they, and even more importantly, simply could not lead white men. And the quarterback is the leadership position. It's the position that everything flows from. And so you had team owners and club executives and head coaches all thinking that if you put a black man at quarterback, your team would fail, that there was no other way around this, that blacks simply could not handle the rigors of the position, the things that you had to do on a day in day out basis to succeed. And I've been doing a lot of interviews around the book, obviously, and some people have said to me, well, you know, that just seems like such a crazy notion. But we've got to remember that for most of American history, there's been a belief among, you know, many white people that black people, you know, from, you know, we can go from slavery to Jim Crow to you know, the emergence of the civil rights movement, you know, in a very large scale in the 1960s, that many white people felt that black people were inferior. And so it stands to reason that the white owners of the NFL, the white coaches, because there were no black coaches, there were no black owners. So it stands to reason that this would be the kind of mood of the day. And it's when you look at these superstar black quarterbacks right now, it's really difficult for people who don't know the history of it to even understand, well, you know, that doesn't make any sense. Well, you know, how could you even say that? But this was, in fact, the case.
Hmm. One of the questions that came to my mind as I was reading about that and thinking about that terrible assumption, of course, that coaches and owners alike were making about black men and their capabilities, it made me wonder, in a terrible sort of way, did they have a point in the sense that what about white players on a given team and their willingness to follow a black man as quarterback? At the time that this was becoming a viable possibility, what is your sense of the presence on the roster of NFL teams of racist white players who would have been offended at the notion of being led by a black quarterback? Or do you think there was not much of that, and was this just a sadly outmoded, gross misunderstanding on the part of coaches and owners?
You know, you're the first person who's asked me that, and I'm glad you did. I think, you know, from all the interviews, and let me go take this back to Marlon Briscoe. You know, I asked Marlon, well, did you feel that your teammates, and, you know, many of his teammates were white, did you feel that your teammates did not, you know, respect you, did not? And he's like, no. I mean, that was the great thing about it, that obviously ownership had that fear. The coaches had that fear. But he told me that, like, when he finally got in it, because he didn't start the season in that job, it wasn't until there were events where people, where the starter got hurt and other people weren't effective. He got in there, but he didn't start the opening game there. But he told me that the sense he got, and, you know, look, let me preface this by saying, no one knows what people say, you know, behind our backs.
Obviously. Right.
But he told me that the sense he got of it was that, at least in the huddle and at least, you know, in a public display, that his white teammates did support him. He never felt that the offensive line didn't block for him. He never felt that, you know, white players at running back or receiver didn't catch for him. He felt like he was respected. Now, having said that, you know, as we look at just the overall feeling about this, I'm sure that if there had been multiple black quarterbacks starting it, yeah, I would not be surprised if several of those quarterbacks' teammates would have had problems with that. Because, look, if we just look at the odds, if you have people in America in the 1960s, and when I say people, I'm talking about white people. If you have white people in the 1960s who have these views that black people are inherently inferior, and I would submit that those views were much more accepted during that time, well, just the odds say that there would be football players who hold those same views. But, you know, we can't test the theory because Marlon was the only one.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting what if, isn't it? Well, at any rate, your book, of course, tells us the story of, for instance, Warren Moon, the great quarterback of both the Oilers and the Seahawks, who I think, if I understand correctly, coming out of his distinguished career at the University of Washington, did not necessarily feel like he was going to be welcomed in the NFL as a quarterback, which is why he took his great talents to the CFL and only eventually back to the NFL. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the thing that's just so insidious about that situation is that Warren Moon was the co-player of the year of his conference as a senior. He helped the University of Washington win the Rose Bowl, a very prestigious Rose Bowl game, and he winds up not getting drafted. I mean, because the year he came out in 1978, the year he came out of college, black men still, on a large scale, were not being, well, not even a large scale, black men basically were not being drafted to play quarterback in the NFL. So he had to go to Canada if he wanted to continue his career as a quarterback. He goes to Canada. He thrives. He becomes a record-setting passer in Canada. He wins championships. Eventually, the NFL can't deny that this guy is, you know, pretty good. And he signs as a free agent with the Houston Oilers. He struggled his first year, but after that transition period, he takes off. He becomes a perennial Pro Bowl player. He finishes high in the NFL MVP voting. He has a great career, and he actually winds up being the only black quarterback enshrined in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But, you know, the thing that's just so sad about that situation is if the people who were running the NFL had been more open-minded, Warren Moon, all those years he was up in Canada, if he had been playing in the NFL all those years, he might own every single passing record there is right now. But because he started in the Canadian Football League and had to spend so many years there, by the time he got to the NFL, you know, he was later in his career. He still had a great career in the NFL, which shows how talented he actually was. But what could have been, you know? We talk about the what-ifs and the what could have been, and I think Warren Moon is a perfect example of that.
Very much so. Among the array of stunningly talented black quarterbacks in the NFL today, of course, we have Patrick Mahomes and Russell Wilson and Dak Prescott and Lamar Jackson and Kyler Murray and, of course, Deshaun Watson, who is making headlines for exactly the wrong reasons with his recent NFL six-game suspension. But by and large, when you look at this current crop of NFL luminaries, beyond their talent and ability and skills, how would you assess them in terms of being, first of all, the face of their teams, as quarterbacks are often thought? And that, of course, was also sometimes at the heart of the reluctance of some owners and coaches to have blacks as their quarterbacks. But how would you assess the way in which they are fulfilling those kind of roles with their teams in terms of being the face of that team and leaders that can be looked up to in more ways than one?
Yeah, you know, it's you're absolutely right that a big part of why these owners, team owners, historically did not want black men to occupy that position is because the quarterback is the face of the team. And, you know, when you're trying to market to your fans, white fans, as we discussed, these owners were very worried about white fans. You know, even if you could clear the hurdle for a team owner thinking a black man could actually succeed at that position, then owners also had to think about, well, would I even want one to succeed, because that might anger many of my white fans. So the guys you're talking about now have shown, all the things, the best traits that you would want in a franchise quarterback. And they lead their teams, and the biggest thing is that they do the things from a optic standpoint that you would want from your franchise quarterback. You know, they're leaders in the locker room. They lead on the field. They set the tone, and that's really what you want. And you know, I'd like to talk about the Deshaun Watson thing for a minute, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
Because Deshaun Watson illustrates that situation, his individual situation, illustrates how far we have come. You know, there was a time in this country when if something happened with a black man, that people would say, white people would say, well, you know, that's indicative of how they are. I'll never forget, you know, in researching the book, that I talked to old timers, and you know, they'd tell me, well, yeah, you know, they would say this person is a credit to his race, or you know, this person, he shows, you know, how well black people can do this. So black people effectively were looked at as a monolith, and they were all lumped in together. The progress that we see is that we can measure the progress in terms of many different metrics, but one is that no one is out here saying that Deshaun Watson situation in any way reflects on Patrick Mahomes, or in any way reflects on Lamar Jackson or Kyler Murray or or Russell Wilson or Dak Prescott. But the allegations about Deshaun Watson and what the NFL is working through right now with handing down disciplinary action for those allegations, it doesn't in any way disparage what these other players are doing. And I think that's very important, because when we look at the rise of the black quarterback, it mirrors the rise of black people in the United States writ large, in the sense that black people are no longer viewed by most, okay, in a manner in which if one black person does something, well, that's what they say all black people do. And I think that's very important, that these young men are looked at and judged as individuals. They're not judged as being, you know, a collective, so to speak, in that if one person does something that is untoward or is alleged to have occurred, that somehow puts a cloud over all of them. And you know, when we talk about progress, we want people to be judged as individuals. You know, we want, you know, I think back to Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech that everybody knows. You know, he talked about being judged by the content of your character, not by the color of your skin. And inherent in that means, I am judged as an individual, not because of the amount of melanin I have.
Hmm.
And so I think it's very important that we look. Things are not perfect in this country or in the NFL. Clearly, racism still exists. But you know, I'd be remiss if I did not acknowledge the progress that has been made. And this Deshaun Watson situation illustrates the progress that has been made.
Hmm. That's a very, very good point, one which had not dawned on me. So I appreciate you you saying that. And I appreciate all that we find in the pages of your really important book, again titled Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America, published by Anscape, which is a division of ESPN. Jason Reed, congratulations on a fine book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was great to talk with you.
Oh, the pleasure was mine, and thank you for having me.